Dry January and alcohol use during the pandemic. Have you found yourself drinking more during the pandemic? You are not alone. Alcohol use and misuse has surged during the pandemic, including binge drinking, which has risen an estimated 21%. Public health experts are worried about the long-term effects such as depression, liver disease, and cancer. Perhaps this is the time for a reset. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, each year now, more and more people are taking part in Dry January, abstaining from alcohol for 1 month in order to give their bodies a break from alcohol. We'll discuss it, drinking and sober living in the age of the pandemic. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling on Demand is made possible by listeners and by Maine General Health, a comprehensive system for all your health care needs. Learn more at MaineGeneral.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. One of the most popular New Year's resolutions in recent years is to take part in Dry January, that is, swearing off alcohol for the month. The idea is taking on greater resonance right now as alcohol use and misuse has surged during the pandemic. Well, here to discuss what our society is like right now in terms of alcohol use, Dr. George Koob, director of the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. Hilary Scheinbaum, the author of The Dry Challenge, How to Lose the Booze for Dry January, Sober October, and Any Other Alcohol-Free Month. And Eric Harum, the director of the Recovery Center at York Hospital. We invite you to join the conversation. Are you taking part in Dry January? Are you thinking about it? Are you wondering if perhaps your alcohol use has gotten out of hand during the pandemic? Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org. Post a comment on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to all of you. Dr. Koob, I'm going to start with you. What do we know about alcohol use during the pandemic? I have read numbers like 21% rise in binge drinking. Does that sound about right to you?
Yeah, I think a more sobering statistic is that alcohol-related deaths have gone up about 25% in the last year. And that comes from the CDC death certificate data. And that is alcohol direct deaths or alcohol related deaths, which range up to, 90,000 people a year. I mean, we talk about the opioid crisis, and there definitely is an opioid epidemic crisis. But, I like to say that alcohol use disorder is the addiction that everybody knows about, but nobody wants to talk about.
How concerning is this to you? Do you think that we are normalizing death by alcohol?
These are significant increases, but we've always had this, if you want to use pandemic terms, an endemic problem with alcohol. And, we've historically lost 70, 80,000 people a year to alcohol. And yes, in some sense, I think we've normalized the risks associated with excessive drinking and alcohol misuse. One of the charges the Institute has taken on in the last few years is to try and get evidence-based information out to the public in this regard and in many other ways that I'm assuming we might get to discuss.
And Dr. Koob, it seems obvious on its face, but I want to ask you, from a research perspective, why is it that people are drinking more? Is it just because there's nothing else to do, that people are sitting at home?
Well, that's part of it. And in fact, the pandemic has really illustrated some major issues that we associate with alcohol misuse. So one is is pretty obvious, is disinhibition. So when people are drinking, they tend to relax their, their concerns about the virus. They might start talking loudly. They might lose their mask or part of their mask off their face. And so you're, this disinhibition that we associate with alcohol intoxication is actually likely to cause or facilitate the spread of a virus, any virus for that matter. And then the second issue is that it's really brought out the fact, something that we've observed for a long, long time, and that is that individuals tend to drink to cope with stress. And when they cross that line into drinking to cope with stress, they're moving themselves toward what I would argue would be a moderate to severe alcohol use disorder. And it's a, you know, it works temporarily during the rising phase of the blood alcohol curve. You feel a little better. You blot out all those memories of all the things you're worried about. But then as the alcohol wears off, these anxieties and problems and stress all comes back with a vengeance. And so I think the pandemic has illustrated these two parts of alcohol misuse, the disinhibition, which, you know, causes all kinds of problems with violence, among other things, and drunk driving and so on and so forth. And also this crossover to drinking to cope with stress, which has been really emphasized in a subgroup of individuals during the pandemic.
Eric Harum, I want to turn to you. What are you seeing here in Maine?
Since the pandemic, we certainly have seen a number of dynamics. One, increased consumption is in Maine mirrors what we're seeing nationally. If we looked at 2019 and 2020 and compared them, alcohol sales were up over 260% in that 1 year following the start.
Let me stop you right there. Up 260%? More than double?
Correct.
Okay, keep going.
So that's an indicator of increased consumption. And you can look at that report from Pollard et al. And really see and break that down by lots of different demographics. And really across the board in adults, there's for men about a 14% increase in consumption and for women about a 17% increase. For adolescents, it's one of the first years, ironically, we've seen the use of substances like cannabis go down. And I think that's by and large been an access issue around social distancing and some of the things that have occurred around that. But for those adolescents who were using substances pre-pandemic, we see a dramatic increase in the amounts and frequencies. And to get to George's point, that decreased inhibition, the likelihood of folks using substances together has increased. And that's in fact why the population that struggles with substance use disorders is one of the higher risk populations for COVID in terms of acquiring the severity of the illness as well as the potential for spread.
Hilary Scheinbaum, your book has been out a little bit more than a year now, and I'm wondering about this year compared to last year. Are you finding a resurgence in interest in this idea of dry January, how to do it, how to approach maybe stopping for a month, seeing if, can I do this? Can I try to stop for a month?
Oh, absolutely. I think just naturally when January rolls around, people are just more interested in being healthier and more mindful. And certainly during the pandemic, with this increase in alcohol consumption, people are really looking to, you know, reel back what they're drinking or reset or just kind of cut it out altogether and see, you know, how they feel. I think that people are, you know, more open this year now that, you know, things are a little bit open, depending on where you live, So they can go and socialize with their friends, and they're hoping to do so without, you know, a glass of beer or, you know, cocktail in hand.
What are you hearing from people, Hillary? What do you hear about the reasons people want to try to go a month without drinking? What are they saying about what they're finding that they have been doing during the pandemic that they did differently? Are you hearing people say things like that one glass of wine has turned into two or three or four every night?
Absolutely. It's turned into the entire bottle. So I really think that, you know, there are so many benefits of cutting out alcohol, even for a mere 31 days, including better sleep, better digestion, certainly an elevated mood, which we can all use. And, you know, there are other things too, like financial savings. So anybody, you know, who might be concerned about losing a job or perhaps, you know, was let go during the pandemic, alcohol can really help, you know, have a healthier relationship, not only with alcohol, but with, you know, your savings account, because alcohol is expensive. So I think that there are, you know, more benefits than we give credit to. And I think beyond just, you know, health benefits, that there are certainly other, other benefits as well.
Dr. Koop, I want to ask you about this trend. You've been studying alcohol and alcoholism, alcohol use and alcoholism for decades, but Dry January is a fairly recent trend. Is this, in your view, a positive idea, a good idea, that people try to just cut out alcohol for a month or so, but then go back to drinking?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, I think our perspective is that this gives you an opportunity to evaluate your relationship with alcohol, and that's absolutely critical. And, you know, we hope that people who do drink stay within the dietary guidelines, which I think most of you know is two drinks a day for men and one drink a day for women. But some people shouldn't be drinking at all, obviously, if you're pregnant, if you have a history of alcohol use disorder, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I think, you know, there really are no drawbacks to decreasing your drinking or stopping your drinking for a month, with the possible two exceptions that, you know, you should keep an eye on. One is if you are indeed a heavy alcohol consumer and may be dependent, abruptly stopping alcohol can be a medical problem. And so you need to get professional help if you're going to taper off drinking, if you're a really heavy drinker, because you can go through withdrawal, and withdrawal can kill you with alcohol dependence. And then the other is there's the famous alcohol deprivation effect. And, you know, I don't know that this is critically important, but after you've done your 30 days or 31 days of January, you got to watch out for the fact that there may be a rebound phenomenon. And it's well documented in the literature that people will then, you know, overdo it on the outside of their 31 day off, on the on part after the off, so to speak.
Well, let me ask you a little bit about both of those. How would you know, you say, if you're a really heavy drinker, you might, or you absolutely need to seek some help and not just try the Dry January? What is the difference? How do you know if you're someone who's a candidate for trying Dry January, just not drinking for a month, or somebody who needs to go to your doctor and get help? What are some questions you need to ask yourself?
Well, I think when you don't drink, you start to sense some signs of withdrawal, which are, you know, more pronounced than a hangover, but similar to a hangover. If you actually start to show a tremor when you're not drinking, that's a telltale sign. But, you know, increased sympathetic activity, like increases in blood pressure and heart rate and so on, some of these are physical signs. Those don't come on unless you're really dependent. And so but if you're just downright flagrantly miserable when you stop drinking abruptly, you may want to check in with your physician.
All right. And Eric, is there anything you want to add to that? What kind of advice would you give people who you work with about who is a person who's a good candidate to try dry January, just not drink for a month? And who's a good candidate to call a helpline or come to someplace like your recovery center?
Well, I think the way I would most simply put that is, if you're examining your own motivation for participating in Jai January, and the answer is to prove to my family that I don't have a problem, that would be perhaps, I think, one of the better indicators that maybe going the route of professional help would be indicated. I agree that when it comes to alcohol consumption, particularly for folks who may be struggling with that, less is better. And so a person participating in Dry January and consuming less over the course of that month would incur some health benefit, including perhaps more clarity in their thinking about their relationship with alcohol. And so again, I think if you're entering into this and the top of your list for why am I doing this is to prove to somebody that I can or I don't have a problem, that would be an indicator that maybe talking with your primary care physician initially would be a good idea.
All right. Hillary, how often do people start by taking part in Dry January or Sober October and then decide, you know what, I'm not going to drink anymore?
You know, it's interesting. So 6.5 million people attempted Dry January last year in 2021. And there is research that shows that up to, you know, I think it's by August, if you're participating in a Dry January specifically, there's a number of people who don't drink at all, like after that and beyond, but certainly lessen their alcohol intake in the months that lead up till August. So that's definitely happened with me. I think, you know, my first Dry January and going back to maybe over, quote unquote, overdoing it, I think that, you know, my first February 1st after a dry month, I personally only had 2 glasses of red wine, but my tolerance had been lowered so significantly that it was probably the worst hangover I've ever experienced. So certainly, you know, after that experience, I was drinking less and less in the months that followed. And now that this is my 6th Dry January, I've definitely decreased my consumption over, you know, the past couple of years as well. So I think it's definitely a possibility. I think, you know, obviously you need to evaluate how much you're drinking to begin with and speak to your doctor. And obviously the, you know, a dry challenge or a dry month is not a method of recovery. But I think that if you are decreasing, you know, your intake, it's certainly, there's a possibility that you might not pick up, you know, a glass ever again.
Dr. Koop.
Yeah, I agree with everything that's been said. But I just want to mention that if when you engage in Dry January, you feel better, that's a telltale sign that maybe your body's trying to tell you something about your relationship with alcohol. So I use that as a marker. I mean, if you feel better when you're not drinking or when you've cut back in drinking, that tells you something. If your interactions with your family are better when you're not drinking or when you've cut down on drinking, that tells you something. If you're doing better at work, I mean, you can all add in all these factors.
So it's a great... looking at you, Dr. Koop, and looking at you, Hillary Scheinbaum and Eric Harum, why not? It's a great experiment.
Absolutely.
We are going to take a quick break. We'd love to hear from you. Have you tried Dry January? Have you tried Sober October? Do you have thoughts about drinking and drinking during the pandemic? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org. Comment on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling. With help from Maine Standard Biofuels, dedicated to providing a cleaner burning home heating oil with no conversion needed. MaineStandardBiofuels.com. And the New England Eating Disorder Program at Sweetser, offering evidence-based telehealth treatment for all ages and genders. Sweetser.org.
Depending on where you are and what you do, this whole supply chain thing can get kind of serious.
I'm getting calls from our pharmacy, not too infrequently, that, you know, medications that our patients are on are backordered.
I'm Kai Rizdal, Rural Medicine and this global economy. Next time on Marketplace.
Join us for Marketplace today at 6:30. Have you subscribed to The 10? The 10 is Maine Public's weekly e-newsletter that takes a closer look at 10 exceptional, thought-provoking, and compelling stories. These stories are not necessarily from this week's headlines. In fact, most are stories that you may have missed from Maine Public, NPR, PBS, the BBC, and more. To sign up or to check out past issues of The 10, please visit mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today, we're talking about dry January or dryuary and what to know about alcohol use and its effects on health. My guest, Hilary Scheinbaum, author of The Dry Challenge, Eric Harum, director of York Hospital's Recovery Center, and Dr. George Koob, who is director of the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. Share your comments and questions via email, talk@mainepublic.org, comment on our Facebook page or Twitter or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Before we get to questions, Dr. Koob, I want to quickly go back to you, though, and ask you, our understanding of what we think about as alcoholism versus alcohol abuse and alcohol misuse has really changed recently, hasn't it? If somebody is of a certain age and thinks about people as either being alcoholics or not being alcoholics, that's really an outdated way of thinking, isn't it?
Yeah, actually, we've stopped using the word alcoholic and alcoholism and alcohol abuse. And this was illustrated in a recent scientific paper that we put out with the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, Nora Volkoff, and the director of the National Institute on Mental Health, Josh Gordon, and pointing out that some of these terms, you know, can convey stigma and perpetuate stigma associated with the disorders. And so to try and be as brief as possible, we now consider what used to be called alcohol dependence or substance dependence on alcohol or alcoholism as a spectrum disorder. It's alcohol use disorder, and other drug addictions are now considered substance use disorders. And this spectrum can be low, moderate, or severe, depending on how many symptoms of 11 symptoms that you actually meet. And so it's kind of important to utilize this framework, in my opinion, and certainly the opinion of the American Psychiatric Association, which formulated this in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual 5 that they put out for mental disorders. And I think considering a spectrum disorder widens the possibility for treatment and early interventions, and it also reduces this negative view that we have of alcohol use disorder, which affects everyone at all socioeconomic levels, all cultures, all different ethnic groups, et cetera, et cetera.
We'll go to Claire, who's calling from New Portland. Hi, Claire, go ahead.
Hi there. My mother struggled with alcohol use disorder for, her whole life. And it took going to a free liver screening. She lives in Florida, to get her to quit because she found out that she was one step away from fatty liver disease. I'm surrounded by a number of people, in my community that are struggling, that don't have a primary care provider, that, would probably go to a free liver screening if it was available, and would only quit if they were told by a medical professional, hey, you're doing your body harm. I'm wondering if that's a possibility, or if it already is, for Mainers, especially rural Mainers, to go get their liver screened for free.
I'll ask both Eric Harum and Dr. Koob this question. Dr. Harum, Eric Harum, do you know if there are free liver screenings in Maine?
You know, that's a great question, and one that I'll have to do some research on.
Okay. And Dr. Koob, I know you wanted to jump in as well.
Yeah, this is a really, really good question and a really good point. And it's something that we're starting to focus on right now at the Institute, because we've come to realize that liver disease and early stages of liver disease are basically a biomarker for moderate to severe alcohol use disorder. And we're working with the American Association of Liver Disease on exactly this issue. And we half of liver disease in the United States now, half of liver disease in the United States now is caused by alcohol. So this is really a great question. Thank you very much for asking it. And all I can tell you is we'll see what we can do. But in the meantime, try and get people to get to their primary care doctor or a primary care doctor within some kind of health system, and do what you can at that level right now until we can do more.
Claire, what we're going to do is try to find an answer to that question and put it in today's Facebook post. So if you are on Facebook, can you circle back to that?
Yes, I can.
All right, great. Thank you. We'll go to Jenna, who's calling from Charleston. Hi, Jenna. Go ahead.
Hey there. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for discussing the topic to start with. We definitely all need to be talking and more aware. My thought was this, that if we're talking about abstaining in either January or October, and it seems like work, or I think you've mentioned a couple times you have to try, that to me means probably already there are some not so great dynamics in someone's relationship with alcohol, because it shouldn't be a big try or a big ask to abstain for 30 days.
Hillary.
I think it's a very good point. I think that there are different factors that can contribute to somebody's, hesitation to try a dry month, or, their struggle. I don't want to use that word, but, kind of what they're up against. And that is, in a lot of situations, I think that people can be social drinkers and they feel an external pressure from friends or family or acquaintances, or even, during work functions, that they need to have a drink in hand in order to participate or be a part of the group. And so I think that being able to say openly, I'm doing a dry month, and giving a reason or not giving a reason, can really empower people in making that decision for themselves, and also, continuing to be successful. I do understand that, drinking has become so embedded in American culture. It's part of celebrations, as I mentioned, networking, it's part of dating, it's part of grieving. So I think that, having the ability to not only state for other people, but for yourself, that you are going to embark on this journey can be a very powerful tool.
Hillary, you'd mentioned the social challenge of this. Can you take some time to give us some tips? You've decided to try Dry January and you are invited over to, we won't say a friend's house or a bar right now because it's the pandemic, but someone's invited you over to their backyard to sit around a campfire, and maybe they're serving drinks, and you are trying Dry January. What's your suggestion?
Yeah, I think, especially if you're going somewhere, if it's a friend's house or a party, and obviously everybody's being COVID safe, you have the opportunity to bring a non-alcoholic beverage to offer, not just for yourself to consume, but for other people. I think also if you're hosting a party, you can, offer your guests non-alcoholic options as well. I think that bars and restaurants have caught on to this phenomenon and are offering, non-alcoholic cocktails on their menus right besides alcoholic ones. And so I think they're, as time goes on, there have been more options. But I think, the bottom line is that you can just tell people whatever it is that you want to tell them. You can tell them that you're not drinking that evening, or that you have an early morning or an exercise class or a deadline coming up, or that you're just not feeling like drinking. Maybe you're the designated driver that night. I mean, there's a million things that you can say, but ultimately the point is that you don't have to explain yourself. It's really, for your benefit, and you're doing it for you.
Michael on Facebook writes, One of your guests said alcohol consumption is up 260%. How does this compare with attendance in alcohol recovery groups? Or is attendance difficult to measure, either due to the anonymity factor of these groups or virtual meetings that may be more commonplace now? And so, Michael, I just want to quickly say our guest said that alcohol sales were up 260%. But Eric, I'm going to throw this back to you. Do you have a sense of recovery groups and whether we've seen more participation in recovery groups here in Maine?
You know, that's been a really challenging thing during the public health emergency. Many of the self-help groups, such as AA or NA, as well as self-help groups for supporting family members, like Al-Anon or Families Anonymous, those have, by and large, gone onto Zoom or other virtual platforms. And the sort of ebb and flow of in-person versus virtual meetings. The virtual availability has certainly kept people connected and kept meetings across the planet, really, up and running and folks supporting one another in much the same fashion. I can say when it comes to professional treatment services, for the first 6 months of the pandemic, we saw about a 30% decrease in the number of people accessing treatment services looking for help. While simultaneously we knew the use rates were going up, evidenced in the increase in sales over the course of the year, but also the increase in overdose deaths and overdose saves. This has really been a significant issue. And stigma, I think, really has been a big part of that. There's a lot of stigma associated with alcohol misuse or with substance use in general. And at a time when we're supposed to be making do and mending and sort of giving our first responders and caregivers space to deal with the pandemic, it's left people with substance use disorders and problems, I think, in an amplified predicament of I need help, I want help, and I'm even more embarrassed to ask for it now because I should be really giving these folks a break so that they can help those people who are sick with COVID. And I think that's a dynamic we've got to sort of unpack for people and let folks know that if you need help, to just ask for it. You can reach out. We've got some resources available on the website from today's program, and I encourage folks in the listening to peruse that and take advantage of those resources.
I have an email here from William. Stopping alcohol consumption for some is extremely difficult. What are the physical and psychological barriers that need to be faced? Dr. Koob.
Well, I as I said earlier, I think if you actually give it a go and discover that reducing your drinking or stopping your drinking makes you feel better, I think your body is telling you something. And I think that's a critical first step. The barriers are obviously some of the things that have already been mentioned by Hillary and Eric, and that is, you know, the social pressures. And so you can find ways to deal with the social pressures, as Hillary elaborated, by bringing a non alcoholic drink to the situation. And when it comes to your own mood states, you need to find alternatives to the negative mood states that are driving the increased drinking or the drinking in general. And so one of the ones that's touted by every institute at the NIH is exercise, okay? It helps your heart, it helps your brain, it helps your weight, it helps your diabetes, it helps everything. So, you know, getting some exercise can be one way to start the process.
I've got a few people recommending great things that have helped them. An email from Rob. I found a great app online called Reframe. It helps you track your alcohol use over time, gives good encouragement and tips, and provides scientific, psychological, biological education about alcohol use. I did drink more during the pandemic, but have cut back a lot and feel much healthier. So that's Reframe. Hillary, have you heard about that app?
Yes, I have heard of Reframe. There's also other apps out there that will track your drinking. And also, I keep on mentioning money, but certainly the amount of financial savings that you, you know, are acquiring over the month. And there are also other programs that, you know, maybe aren't 100% sobriety focused, but they do encourage drinking less. And you can find them, not necessarily, but there are definitely a few.
Great. And also Holly says there are several new books out with sophisticated, delicious cocktails that have no or low alcohol. These are not Shirley Temples, but real grown-up drinks. Julia Bainbridge's book, Good Drinks, is exceptional and a great place to start. And Hillary, I see you nodding. And then for Claire, who called earlier, Eric has written in our notes here, the Maine Rural Health Research Center, ruralhealthresearch.org, is a great place to go for liver screenings in rural Maine. So Eric, thank you for doing that research live on the air for us. And we'll also post that on our webpage and on Facebook. Hillary, did you want to add to a list of books with great mocktail recipes?
Yeah, there are a few in my book, actually, but a really great, beautiful book is by Elva Ramirez, and it is called Zero Proof Drinks, and that came out in the spring. So I highly recommend her book. It's lovely.
All right. So a little pushback on sort of the whole major societal pressure of building our whole culture around drinking.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to you, Hillary. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. I didn't realize. Yeah, I think that there are so many different resources now. And certainly, you know, not just these non-alcoholic recipe books, but I know that in New York specifically, there are now alcohol-free bottle shops that offer non-alcoholic cocktails if you don't want to make your own at home. They're pre-made. There's also non-alcoholic spirits that range from, you know, tequila to bourbon to gin, and certainly there are non-alcoholic wines and there are non-alcoholic beers now. So if you are feeling like you want to participate in cocktail hour, but you don't want to, you know, have a buzz or wake up with a hangover, there are other options across the board.
We do need to take another quick break. We are talking with experts about quitting alcohol, whether for dry January or for a lifetime. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling. With help from Maine Humanities Council with The Big Question, a series of guided discussions starting with the question, what if? Register at mainehumanities.org. And Androscoggin Home Healthcare and Hospice, helping Medicare patients with palliative and hospice care at home or at their hospice house in Auburn.
I'm Scott Tong. Supporters of former President Donald Trump are seeking to replace elections officials across the country. One Republican election supervisor in Florida has had to push back against a citizen-led effort to investigate voter fraud. Wesley Wilcox calls the residents' claims absurd. That's next time on Here and Now.
Join us for Here and Now today at noon. Maine Public is pleased to be a media sponsor of Penobscot Theater Company's production of Tell Me on Sunday. This musical in one act by Andrew Lloyd Webber tells the story of an English girl who travels to the United States in search of romance. Tell Me on Sunday will be performed through January 23rd at the Bangor Opera House, and Maine Public members are eligible for 15% off tickets to the show. For complete details, please visit mainepublic.org and click on events.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You are listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, talking about alcohol use and dry January. With me, Eric Harum with York Hospital's Recovery Center, Dr. George Koob, the director of the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, and Hillary Scheinbaum, author of The Dry Challenge. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. If you're quick, you can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. Dr. Koob, this past year, NIAA released some really interesting research about women and drinking. And that research shows that women are drinking as much as men, but for different reasons. And it's really kind of shocking, isn't it?
Well, yes and no, because on the shocking part, because the women have been catching up with men as far as drinking goes for the last 20, 30 years. And actually, some, you're correct, some of our recent data suggests that in college age groups, that women are actually drinking more than men for the first time, and maybe binge drinking on college campuses more than men for the first time. The problem with the shocking part of it, which I agree with, is the fact that women tend to drink more to cope with stress than men, and women are more vulnerable to some of the pathological effects of alcohol, particularly everything ranging from mood disorders that are comorbid with alcohol to liver disease. And the danger is that, you know, if a woman with who's generally smaller than a man and also has less body water per kilogram than a man drinks the same amount as a man, the actual absolute same amount as a man, they're going to get a much higher blood alcohol level, which may convey some of this potential additional pathophysiology associated with alcohol.
And Hillary, we're learning some things about the generations in drinking, different ways that the Gen Zs and millennials approach drinking than their parents did.
Yes, absolutely. There has been research that suggests that millennials are definitely drinking less than Gen X, and Gen Z is drinking less than millennials. So it's very interesting to see how that is not only impacting, you know, the life around us, but certainly how brands are reacting to that as well, because, you know, these big brands, their bottom line is that, you know, they want to make money. So I think that a lot of not only, you know, the niche brands that I had mentioned, where there's non-alcoholic wines, beers, and spirits, but larger brands like Heineken are putting out 0.0 proof, you know, beers. And Diageo, which is obviously known for its range of spirits, purchased Seedlip, which is a non-alcoholic spirit. So I think that, you know, obviously these big brands would not be putting money into things that were not making them money. And so I think that it shows that the tides are really turning for younger generations who are, you know, less likely to imbibe when they're socializing.
Eric, here in Maine, are we seeing more Gen Zs and millennials smoking marijuana or using marijuana because of the legalization here? I mean, I know it's a little off topic, but it's the reality here in Maine, especially in the last year.
Yeah, and I think this sort of is akin to what Hillary's framing up around, you know, the drinking patterns for Gen X, millennials, and Gen Zs. In a similar fashion, the medical and recreational nature of the cannabis laws here in Maine have impacted greater availability, reduced price, increased potency, and of course, increased access. And we certainly have seen an increase in the use of those substances, particularly concentrates, versus sort of the buds or flower, which is, I think, the more traditional way we think of cannabis from 80s, 90s, and the aughts. Really now what we're seeing is lots of different types of concentrate formulations. So things like dabs, shatter, wax, you know, those are the names of those products that come in much, much higher potency levels, in the 90% or higher THC levels. And I think that's the trade-off in some ways when we look at substances of choice and our generations.
I'll go to Miriam calling from South Portland. Hi, Miriam, go ahead.
Good morning and thank you for the show. I want to speak briefly from my own experience. I'm a 73-year-old widow in South Portland, Maine. My experience is that alcoholism is a disease in my family. My mother was the person who drank every evening, never in public. I was not taught self-regulation as a child, so I see a trauma specialist each week for relational childhood trauma. I believe our society says things like drink responsibly and gives a slap on the hand. My only brother was in a bed for 20 years, not walking and not talking as a result of someone else's driving drunk. I feel very strongly that each person has a choice every day about how present we want to be in this world. whether we overwork, oversex, overdrink, oversmoke. It doesn't matter. We can be present or we can be numb. And I just wanted to offer my own personal viewpoint. I want to say briefly that Al-Anon has been extremely helpful to me, and there is a lot of support. I also believe that our society promotes this double standard because so much money and profit is made from selling alcohol and also from running recovery. Thank you for the program.
Miriam, thanks for your call. Dr. Koob, thoughts?
Well, she has illustrated very, very elegantly many of the problems associated with alcohol use disorder. It does run in families, that there is a genetic loading. That loading can also involve the environment, as she pointed out, which is the trauma of growing up in a family with alcohol use disorder. She's illustrated all the ills associated with over-drinking, including drunk driving. And also some of the options people have to exit from this. And I turn it to Eric, who can maybe elaborate on that point.
Sure. And thanks, Dr. Koob, for that. And I do want to be able to mention and have provided this link for the audience and those listening. The state has really promoted and developed a statewide program called Know Your Options. And you can go to that website. And the link that I provided is a landing page. And within each county, each 16 counties in the state, we have licensed professional counselors who are navigators and interventionists and can assist with navigating resources that can include harm reduction, that can include professional treatment services, that can include recovery supports, as well as anything that what we say it might be missing in Maslow. If you're struggling with housing, with food insecurity, childcare, those are all barriers that pose problems for people getting the help that they need or want. And so again, looking at that options website and contacting what's called an options liaison in the county where you are is a wonderful free resource and one that I want to make sure people can take advantage of.
Miriam, thanks for your call. We'll go over to Buxton and Sam. Hi, Sam, go ahead.
Hi, all the work you're doing is great and the suggestions you're offering for apps and programs, but it all is dependent upon access to healthcare. People don't have primary care doctors. They don't have annual exams so they need to seek out free test clinics. There aren't sufficient mental health services in part because people don't have health insurance. What we really need is universal healthcare. So if you want to address this issue with substance abuse and alcohol abuse as a result of a pandemic or whatever cause, you really also need to address the lack of universal health care because people just don't go see the doctor. It's too expensive. They can't afford it. They don't have access. So they don't get the treatment, whether it's because of this type of abuse or something else. It's all related to the fact, ultimately, that they have no access universally to health care. So
Sam,
because of that expense.
Yeah, Sam, I'm sure there are many, many people nodding their heads in agreement with you right now. And a major challenge in Maine here right now. I'm going to move on because we're near the end of the program. I want to get as many calls in as possible. Going to Karen in Portland. Hi, Karen. Go ahead.
Hello. I really, really appreciate the breadth that you guys are covering because it is such a pervasive condition and the problems that it can cause. And the two things that I really want to focus on myself from my personal experience are stigma and the way that your support system matters. I stopped drinking. I never had a problem with drinking. I never was problematic. And I stopped drinking when I was pregnant and then when I was nursing my sons. And when I started to drink again, turned out I break out in hives. And my friends were very invested in figuring out, oh, maybe it was red wine, maybe it was wine grown on this side of the hillside, maybe it was added sulfites. People were so invested in finding me a different alcohol that I could drink. And I just said, you know what? It's not worth it because I drink, I break out in a horrible rash, I have to take Benadryl, and I fall asleep. And yet other people were more invested in making sure I could continue to drink than I was.
Yeah, interesting and, story. And Hillary, you're nodding. You've heard this before.
I've just heard, you know,
that my son has had some substance abuse issues, and I found myself explaining why I couldn't drink and making sure people knew it wasn't that I had a substance abuse problem. But when he started having trouble, I realized it's the same thing. When I drink, bad things happen. When he drinks, bad things happen.
Right. I'm going to let Hillary respond. We're getting close to the end of the show. Hillary, go ahead.
Thanks. Yeah, I was just going to say, I think it becomes easier when you have somebody, you know, doing a dry challenge or not drinking with you. Certainly that is a big form of support. And similarly, I have friends who will cut out every single thing from their diet, ranging from dairy to gluten to meat to and to each their own, of course, but they will not give up alcohol. And that is the first thing that I always suggest that they cut out if they're having ailments. So I, to your point, like absolutely, I've seen it in my friend group too.
Yeah. Hillary, thank you. Karen, thanks so much for your call. And we just have a couple minutes left. And Dr. Koob, I just want to sort of ask you, because you've done this work for so long, about this moment in our culture and the fact that people are talking about dry January and sober October, and the fact that there are places, very trendy, hip places popping up in America's big cities that offer mocktails. Do you sense a shift in our culture's attitude toward alcohol?
The simple answer is yes. And I'd be happy if our culture would put us out of business. But I want to mention two resources that NIAAA have for people who really want to investigate possible problems with alcohol. They're very simple. Rethinking Drinking, if you type that into a search engine, you'll come up with a lot of good information, some of which we've discussed here. It's called Rethinking Drinking. And the other is for treatment, NIAAA Treatment Navigator, which tells you what an alcohol use disorder is, tells you what kind of treatments are important for what stage of an alcohol use disorder or what level you're in. And you can type in your zip code and find a treatment facility that's potentially available in your area. And finally, you know, to your question, we are working on what we call a clinician core resource, which we hope to get out very soon, probably in the next month or two, that will provide information for every health provider of what they should know about alcohol. And I think, you know, I think we want to take advantage of this shift that Hillary has talked about, that Eric's talked about, that you have talked about, because I think we could save a lot of money in healthcare if people actually dealt with the alcohol part of the healthcare problem.
I really appreciate the time you have all given us today. Dr. George Koob, the director of the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. Hillary Scheinbaum, the author of The Dry Challenge, How to Lose the Booze for Dry January, Sober October, and Any Other Alcohol-Free Month. And Eric Harum, director of the Recovery Center at York Hospital. He's also provided us with great links here in Maine. Today's sound engineer, KG Akeem Aladun, Maine Calling produced by Cindy Hahn and Jonathan Smith. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.